Welcome to the Nautocast Tech Briefing. I'm your host, and today we've got a lineup that really questions how we work and how we shop.
Yeah, we're starting off with something that might finally explain that 2 p.m. brain fog you get during long strategy meetings. It turns out it might not be the heavy lunch you ate. It could literally be the air in the room.
We're also doing a deep dive into the retail wars, specifically how Costco has built a massive, thriving business by doing the exact opposite of what Amazon does.
It's a fascinating look at the limits of infinite choice versus the power of curated physical retail.
Exactly. And later on in the roundup, we'll touch on a great piece from the creator of the Marginalia search engine about the painful but necessary process of learning new things.
Plus, a blast from the past that's trending again. A complete breakdown of what you're actually looking at when you run HTOP on a Linux server.
All that coming up. Let's get into the first story.
So this first piece comes from Mike Bowler's blog, and it's titled, "The Bottleneck Might Be the Air in the Room." And it's one of those things that once you hear the numbers, you immediately start reevaluating every enclosed conference room you've ever been trapped in.
Seriously, the premise here is about carbon dioxide levels and how they impact cognitive function. Bowler points out that outdoor CO2 levels are generally around 400 parts per million. But in a standard meeting room with the door closed, those levels frequently exceed 2,000 parts per million.
And that spike happens remarkably fast. You get 4 or 5 people in a small room with poor ventilation, and within an hour, the air quality just plummets. But what's really striking here is the data backing up what that actually does to our brains.
Right. The post cites a study from the Lawrence Berkeley National Laboratory that is honestly a little terrifying if you think about where high-stakes corporate decisions are made. They found that at just 1,000 parts per million, which is easily achievable in a typical office, decision-making performance dropped on 6 out of 9 measures.
And it gets worse. When they pushed the CO2 concentration to 2,500 parts per million, which, again, is not uncommon in a crowded, poorly ventilated space, performance dropped on 7 of the 9 measures. And some of those metrics fell to what the researchers described as dysfunctional levels.
That word dysfunctional really jumps out. We're not just talking about feeling a little sleepy. We're talking about a measurable, significant impairment in cognitive ability. Harvard researchers have also corroborated this, noting that cognitive scores, especially for strategy and information processing, take a massive hit as CO2 rises.
Which is exactly the kind of thinking you need in a strategy meeting. It's this bizarre paradox where companies will gather their most expensive talent, put them in a room to make critical decisions, and inadvertently create an environment that actively suppresses their ability to process information.
Bowler calls this an invisible bottleneck, which I think is the perfect term for it. We tend to attribute that afternoon fog to other things. We think, oh, I didn't sleep well, or I had too many carbs for lunch, or this presentation is just incredibly boring.
And maybe the presentation is boring, but the CO2 is definitely not helping. It really makes you wonder if the whole concept of the afternoon slump in corporate productivity is actually just a widespread ventilation problem.
It's a structural issue. Modern office buildings are often sealed environments designed for energy efficiency, which means they aren't always pulling in enough fresh air. When you pack people into a glass box, they are literally consuming the oxygen and replacing it with a gas that makes everyone dumber.
So the obvious question here is, should organizations treat air quality monitoring as a standard requirement? Not just for comfort, but for the actual quality of the work being produced.
I think absolutely. If you look at the cost of a basic CO2 monitor, it's trivial compared to the hourly rate of the people sitting in that room. If you see the meter hitting 1,000 or 1,500 parts per million, that should be an immediate signal to open a door, take a break, or move to a different space.
It also has implications for the work-from-home crowd. A lot of people are working in small home offices, maybe a converted closet or a spare bedroom with the door shut to keep the kids out. You could be experiencing that same cognitive decline without even realizing it.
Exactly. And it ties into a broader conversation about how we design our workspaces. We focus so much on the software tools, the collaboration platforms, the ergonomics of the chair, but we completely ignore the invisible medium we're all swimming in.
If a piece of enterprise software was causing a 50% drop in strategic thinking, companies would rip it out immediately. But because it's the HVAC system, it just gets ignored.
It really is a wake-up call. I know I'm going to be paying a lot more attention to the ventilation in the room the next time I have to make a tough call.
Let's dig a little deeper into that Harvard study you mentioned, because the specifics are really revealing. They didn't just measure general intelligence. They looked at very specific cognitive domains. Strategy, as you noted, was one of the hardest hit, but they also saw massive declines in basic activity levels and crisis response.
Right, which means not only are you worse at planning for the future in a stuffy room, but if something goes wrong, your ability to react to a crisis is severely compromised. The only metric that didn't seem to drop as drastically was focused activity, like heads down, repetitive tasks. But anything requiring lateral thinking or complex problem solving just fell off a cliff.
It makes you wonder how many terrible business decisions over the last few decades can be traced back to a poorly ventilated boardroom. You have executives grinding out a 12-hour negotiation. The doors are closed for confidentiality. And by hour 8, nobody has the cognitive capacity to realize they're agreeing to a terrible deal.
It's the ultimate argument for the walking meeting. Steve Jobs was famous for taking people on long walks when he needed to hash out a difficult problem. People always attributed that to his quirky personality or the benefits of physical exercise, but maybe it was just the fact that they were outside, breathing air with only 400 parts per million of CO2.
That's a great point. And going back to Bowler's piece, he emphasizes that this isn't just about feeling tired. It's a physiological limit on your brain's performance. The brain requires a massive amount of oxygen to function at peak capacity. When you replace that with CO2, you are fundamentally starving the engine.
And yet, how many offices have you been in where the thermostat is locked behind a plastic box and the vents are basically just recycling the same stale air? The focus in building management is almost entirely on temperature control and energy savings. CO2 levels are rarely monitored, let alone actively managed.
I think we're going to see a shift there. As sensors become cheaper and more integrated into smart building systems, it wouldn't surprise me if CO2 monitoring becomes a standard feature. Imagine a conference room that automatically kicks up the ventilation or even flashes a subtle warning light when the air quality starts to degrade.
That would be brilliant. Warning, cognitive function is currently at 70%. Please open a window.
Yeah, crack a window if you can, leave the door open if confidentiality allows it. It's such a simple fix, but the data clearly shows it could have a massive impact on the quality of your work.
Moving on to our next story, we have a really compelling analysis from Phenomenal World titled "Costco is the Anti-Amazon." This piece looks at the fundamental philosophies driving two of the biggest forces in retail today, and how Costco is thriving by essentially doing the exact opposite of the Amazon playbook.
It's a great framing. When we think about the future of retail, the dominant narrative is almost always Amazon. It's about infinite assortment, ultra-fast delivery, complex algorithmic logistics, and frictionless digital purchasing. But Costco represents this massive, highly successful counter-narrative.
Exactly. Let's look at the numbers, because they really tell the story. Amazon lists hundreds of millions of products. They want to be the everything store. Costco, on the other hand, limits its inventory to roughly 4,000 stock-keeping units, or SKUs, per warehouse.
That is an incredibly curated selection. For a store that massive, 4,000 items is nothing. You go to a typical supermarket and they might have 40,000 SKUs. Costco is actively restricting choice. They aren't offering you 20 different brands of ketchup. They're offering you one or two, but in massive quantities.
And that restriction of choice is a feature, not a bug. By limiting the SKUs, Costco can leverage immense purchasing power. They buy in such massive bulk that they can demand rock-bottom prices from suppliers, and they pass those savings on to the consumer.
Which brings us to the margins. The piece notes that Costco maintains an average gross margin of approximately 10%. That is extraordinarily low. Most major retailers are operating on margins of 25 to 30%, if not higher.
So how do they make any money? This is where the genius of the Costco model comes in. they don't really make their profit on the groceries or the TVs. They make it on the membership fees. The membership-based revenue model provides a steady, predictable stream of income, which essentially subsidizes the low product prices.
Right. They are essentially a club that you pay to access, and the perk of the club is that you get goods at near cost. And it's working beautifully. The article points out that Costco's revenue has grown by an average of more than 10% annually over the last 5 years. They are a juggernaut.
But what's really interesting is the philosophical divide here. Amazon is all about removing friction. You click a button and the item magically appears on your porch the next day. You don't have to leave your couch. Costco is entirely about friction, but in a way that creates a specific type of value.
Yeah, you have to drive to a massive warehouse, navigate a crowded parking lot, show a card to get in, push a giant cart down concrete aisles, and buy things in quantities that require you to rearrange your pantry. It is an intensely physical brick-and-mortar experience.
And yet, people love it. They call it the treasure hunt experience. Because the inventory rotates, you go in for toilet paper and rotisserie chicken, and you walk out with a kayak and a 3-pound tub of mixed nuts. It's an event.
The piece poses a really interesting question. Does this anti-Amazon model offer a more sustainable path for retail? Or is it just a niche experience that will eventually have to adapt to the demand for digital convenience?
I think it's more than a niche. Costco's reliance on physical infrastructure and bulk purchasing creates a massive moat. Amazon's logistics are incredible for delivering small parcels quickly, but delivering a 40-pack of bottled water or a 50-pound bag of dog food to an individual home is incredibly inefficient and expensive.
Exactly. The last-mile delivery problem is the hardest and most expensive part of e-commerce. Costco outsources the last-mile delivery to the customer. You drive your own car to the warehouse and load up your own trunk. From a supply chain perspective, moving pallets of goods directly into a warehouse where the customer acts as the final delivery driver is incredibly efficient.
And that efficiency is what protects them from Amazon. Amazon can't easily replicate the economics of a Costco warehouse without fundamentally altering their own model. The Phenomenal World piece really highlights how these two giants are basically playing different games.
It also touches on the social aspect of consumption. There's an argument to be made that the Costco model, despite the massive scale, is actually more socially and economically grounded than the hyper-individualized Amazon model. You're interacting with people. You're experiencing the scale of consumption physically, rather than just clicking a screen and having cardboard boxes pile up on your porch.
Plus, Costco pays its employees notably well for the retail sector, offering good benefits and higher hourly wages, which contributes to very low turnover. That's a stark contrast to the often criticized labor practices in e-commerce fulfillment centers.
It really is a fascinating debate about the future of consumption. We tend to assume that technological progress inevitably leads to everything being digital, frictionless, and delivered to our doors. But Costco proves that there is still immense value in physical curation, bulk efficiency, and a business model that prioritizes long-term membership over individual transaction margins.
It'll be interesting to see how both companies evolve. Amazon has obviously made moves into physical retail with Whole Foods and Amazon Fresh, trying to capture some of that brick-and-mortar footprint. But Costco seems perfectly content to just keep opening massive warehouses and sticking to their highly disciplined, low-SKU strategy.
If it ain't broke, don't fix it. And with consistent 10% annual growth, it is definitely not broke.
All right, let's pivot and hit a few more stories real quick before we wrap up.
Sounds good. What's first?
First up, a piece that gained a lot of traction on Hacker News recently titled Maybe You Should Learn Something. It's a blog post from Viktor Lovgren, the Swedish software engineer who created the indie search engine Marginalia. He argues that learning new skills, whether it's pixel art, 3D modeling, or a language, requires serious expectation management because the initial phase is usually physically and mentally exhausting. He calls that initial phase Mount Awful, which is painfully accurate. He suggests that you need consistent, daily practice of about 30 to 45 minutes to push through that and reach what he calls a logarithmic plateau of intermediate competence. It's a really refreshing counter-narrative to hustle culture.
It's not about hacking your productivity. It's about accepting that being bad at something is the necessary first step to being good at it.
Next, we have a blast from the past that's been making the rounds again. Peteris Crewman's comprehensive 2019 guide explaining of everything you can see in htop/top on Linux. If you've ever stared at a Linux terminal wondering what the color-coded bars and dense metrics actually mean, this is the definitive breakdown.
Yeah, HTOP is an absolute staple for system administrators, but it's notoriously intimidating for beginners. The guide clears up a lot of common misconceptions, especially around how load average relates to CPU core counts. It's a great reminder that while modern dashboards are flashy, sometimes you just need a deep understanding of the raw, text-based metrics that keep the servers running.
And that is going to do it for today's episode of the NoraCast Tech Briefing.
As always, you can find links to all the stories we discussed in the show notes.
Thanks for listening. We'll be back tomorrow with more of the latest in tech, AI, and everything in between.
See you then.